We've never done that before. I'll start.
Tripped over each other.
Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. As two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, Ben and Tim seek out people leading lives less ordinary and talk with them about how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further. Like intellectual bowerbirds, we aim to collect shiny little objects of knowledge that we think can help build better humans.
G'day everyone and welcome to the Unforgiving 60 podcast. My name is Ben Pronk.
And my name is Tim Curtis, and I'm not sure why you clapped, because that's a sync clap. What were we trying to sync?
No, I was just trying to wake you up.
Ah, gotcha. Yep. Well, it worked.
It was just a, let's go. Get your game face on for this very cool podcast.
Increase the stress load in me.
Ah, interesting segue into what we're going to talk about. Now, Tim, we love it when people reach out, when people give us feedback of any kind, but in particular, when people give us guest recommendations. How would one give us a guest recommendation, Tim?
You can reach out on email, debrief@unforgiving60.com, or anywhere on our socials. We are attentive to them all.
Yeah. And Ben Meadley did exactly that. Ben, we owe you a incredible debt of gratitude because you reached out on the Debrief account and gave us not one but two guest recommendations, both of whom were kind enough to accept the offer. Rachel Vickery, we heard from a couple of weeks back. And this week's guest was also a recommendation from Ben, Associate Professor Luana Main.
Dr. Luana Main at Deakin. First life, I guess, as an athlete and a coach, but also always had an interest in sport and athletic performance. Mm. Did her PhD at the University of Western Australia. Mm-hmm. And is currently at Deakin, where she's incredibly well published on the subject of stress and performance and all things in between, and not just in the demographic of athletes, but also has crossed over and done some stuff with military demographics.
Yeah, and one of the really cool things about Luana's work is that she is super focused on the applicability, the practicality of this. We sort of joke about academic research for its own sake and appealing only to another small group of academic researchers. That's certainly not the case with the work Luana's doing. She's looking at stuff that can really move the needle in real life. And we're going to talk to her about some of her findings in that space, in the areas of stress, of performance, of increasing sort of your ability to function both physically and cognitively under training load.
She might also resolve a debate that rages in this office, which is what is the best wearable?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Yeah, that would be good to finally have resolution and proof that I'm correct.
Maybe first principles, are wearables actually any good?
Mm.
Do they give you any accurate indication, or are they gimmicky?
And do they give you more than a just subjective, you know, how's your feeling kind of assessment might?
And how objective and subjective things work together to collaborate.
Looking forward to talking to Luana about all of this stuff.
Let's get on with the show. Well, he parked his car outside the Rose Hotel, and he headed for the bar. And not a wink and ever vest a smile as he motioned for a jar. Well, he ain't been home since 1973. 17. And by 21 it sailed the seven seas, but it never seemed that far.
And welcome back to the Unforgiving 60 podcast. I'm Ben Pronk.
And I'm Tim Curtis.
And we are joined by Luana Main. Luana, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
I probably Luana Main should have gone the Associate Professor Dr. Luana Main to me, but it's wonderful to have you on the show. Look, as we covered in our intro, a pretty amazing background, a pretty incredible field of interest, and certainly a lot of overlap with the kind of stuff we find interesting. But can you tell us a little about how you got interested in these areas and how you got to where you are now?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as many kids do, I had a huge interest in sport. And so when I went to uni, I wanted to study sports science, thinking that I was going to go and become a PE teacher. not realizing that research was a career pathway. And I can actually pinpoint a third year lecture where Dr. Carmel Goodman, who was the medical doctor at WAIF, was talking about this concept of overtraining syndrome and how athletes can have the perfect training program and they can still overtrain. And I said, well, why can't we monitor for that? Why can't we try and pick this up early on? And that was really the starting point of how I got onto this journey of investigating this idea of overtraining syndrome in athletes, but then more broadly in physically demanding occupations. And so that, I'm not going to say how long ago that third year lecture was, but after that I did an honours study looking at overtraining and whether we could use subjective measures, so questionnaires, to detect early onset training distress, and that went into a PhD, and I continued to look at potential ability of subjective measures to track athlete responses to training loads. We developed a questionnaire that's now been validated and it's used globally to monitor athletes' training responses. But also part of that was so that coaches had something that they could use. Like I think we made a point earlier, there's no point about doing research for research's sake if there's no translation to practice or if there's no impact for end users and stakeholders. So I really was conscious about that. But I also wanted to understand what this overtraining syndrome, and there's quite a few hypotheses out there, but the one I was really interested in was the potential role of inflammatory cytokines. So they're basically messenger molecules that float around the body, and you know, it's part of the normal immune response. And long story short, that's kind of still an area I'm really interested in, but the potential role they were playing in the development of overtraining syndrome, which is kind of where it all started, and have sort of continued along that sort of trajectory.
Which is awesome. And I mean, given that right from the outset, how does the scientific community define overtraining? Is there a specific definition, or is this part of the sort of drama getting our arms around this thing?
No, certainly. So the I think it's European Journal of Sports Sciences or European Congress of Sports Sciences, they came out with a position statement probably back in 2006 and then an updated one in 2013, I think it was, that basically defines this training continuum from we need a certain amount of overload or lead to positive training adaptation. I think we all know that. That's fairly well accepted. That's why we have periodized training programs. So that can lead us to a sort of this sort of functional overreaching, you know, think of training camps. Then when the needle tips sort of too far, you end up in this non-functional overreach state, and that's where we're starting to see a maladaptive response. We're seeing a decrement in performance despite increases in training load. And normally you can't really diagnose overtraining syndrome until after that you know how long the recovery trajectory is. So that can be weeks to months to even years, whereas sort of the functional sort of days to recover from, and then a non-functional sort of like more the weeks of recovery.
And clearly, like you've just expressed an interest in the sort of biomarkers and how we can potentially tell some of these canaries in the coal mine. But at a more lay perspective, are there, I guess, subjective symptoms that people can identify? I know you're probably smiling because that's a super dumb question.
It's not a dumb question. People get grumpy. In fact, that's one of the most consistent findings. And for a long time has been that often it's the subjective measures that sort of give you that early indication that something's not tracking right before it can even be detected by an objective marker. And it's things like being grumpy and irritable and stressed and tired and sore. And I mean, all the usual things that you guys have probably experienced during periods of heavy training. So seems common sense, but it's often surprising that people don't pay attention to that sort of shift.
Well, it's funny. We talk a lot about that relationship between performance and stress and, you know, really keen to come back to some of your work on the good, bad and ugly of stress. But we often show the Yerkes-Dodson inverted U and talk about, you know, that insidious space where you're just overstressed and you probably don't even notice it and you're just that frog in boiling water. And just last week in a workshop, I got that question, well, how do I know if I'm in that zone? And I think there's probably a lot of parallels that maybe you personally don't, but the people around you certainly will.
Absolutely. Yeah, people you're living with can probably tell you.
You published on subjective self-reporting measures being as good as objective measures. I guess that also requires a level of self-awareness, that it's not something else's fault, someone else's fault, but you can look a little internally, hold yourself at arm's length and recognise these issues. Can we talk about the subjective v. objective measures?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things I've inevitably found is when you start asking athletes to reflect on how they're feeling, and anyone actually, it increases their own self-awareness. So a frustrating thing across the longitudinal study is they'll actually start self-correcting.
Getting better at it.
Because they increase their self-awareness. So part of it's just a self-awareness piece and an education piece.
On self-awareness and visualization, do you have any working theories, hypothesis on the importance of visualization or not as it relates to stress load and or performance?
It depends, I think, on the nature of the stressor. So a stressor could be something like physical load, calorie restriction, thermal stress, sort of like a social emotional, a pre-competition stress. I'm sure I've missed one, restricted sleep. You know, there's a whole heap of
I guess work-related stuff as well. And I think a lot of, amateur athletes don't factor that in. They're looking at the training they're doing, but not what's going on.
Not the young child in the house, Luana.
Or it's sleep-deprived nights, study period exams, depending on your life stage. So I think visualizations can be incredibly effective depending on the nature of the stressor. So if it's like you've got an acute stressor, like you're going to go and give a public speech or a presentation, or you're standing at the starting line of an event and leading up sort of the days and sort of weeks leading up to that kind of a stressor, visualizations can be really effective, like your pre-performance routines, depending on the duration of the event, even during the event, depending on what the task is. I think they can be really powerful. But for some of the other sources of stress, I'm not sure what the literature would say for those. But I think anything that you can do, like if you're in an over-aroused state, anything you can do to get that back into control, I think you guys talk about the box breathing a lot, that's going to be valuable to help control those arousal levels.
It's interesting you talk about those two, you know, almost that steady state or allostatic sort of load and then that performance go time sort of load, the acute stuff. You, as a recommendation for this podcast, came as part of a box set. So Ben Meadley, one of our listeners, who himself is an associate professor at Monash, had recommended that we reach out to both you and Rachel Vickery, who we spoke to a couple of weeks ago. And Rachel spoke about very similar sort of stuff. She speaks about trying to increase that buffer so that our allostatic, our baseline sort of load is a bit lower. So we've got room to spike for that unexpected thing or that public speech or whatever, and we can use some of those acute techniques in that go time moment, as she refers to it. But interested in your thoughts, I know, and Ben actually asked us to ask you about your work on allostatic load. Can we lower that baseline to increase that buffer? What sort of things should we be looking at there?
Yeah, I think so. So I think when you're talking allostatic load, you're talking about that cumulative impact of repeat exposures.
Sure.
So I think anything that you can do to help reduce that, so look at your sleep, look at your hydration, look at your calorie intake, all those usual things about taking care of yourself are going to put your body in its best position to deal with stress.
Are there ways, I mean, all of this stuff, as you said, you know, these are the basics. And interestingly, Rachel said the same thing, and we're not naive enough to think that there's a silver bullet here. But how do people get better at these? Like you mentioned self-awareness before as a great step. Have athletes or your research participants had benefits from, I don't know, logging these things or journaling or gamifying sleep or using biometrics? Any thoughts on that you've seen from your research?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, logging, having a training diary or something is obviously really valuable, but in an occupation context, that's potentially going to be slightly different. You could certainly journal your experiences, but something like a wearable device, you know, anything off the shelf is going to give you some insights into your sleep, your activity. I quite like using heart rate variability as a metric to indicate the load that your body's under. You know, so those sorts of things, and they track it for you, so you don't have to, it's not yet another thing you have to remember to write down, because try as I might as a sports scientist, my training journal is very hit and miss, but I'm always logging it on my watch. So.
Yeah.
You won't be able to go to the pub because the pub is shut. That doesn't mean you can have all your mates round to home and get on the beers.
I I'm a particular fan of HRV, and I'm actually keen to pick your brains because I would love to hear your description of it and it as a proxy for, I guess, stress and recovery. But in particular, I like wearing a Whoop, and that's got the ability to get that raw data, but it's also got the subjective journal, and it sort of correlates. Okay, well, the nights that I wear, real example, blue light blocking glasses, for example, it increases my recovery. You know, so I found that interesting because the academic research seems a bit mixed on blue light blocking, but for me it works. You can do those experiments, those little N equals one experiments, and see what impact it has. But you could you talk to it or provide our listeners a bit more detail on HRV, heart rate variability, what it is, and why it's a good or an appropriate proxy for stress?
Yeah, sure. I should say I need to credit one of my former PhD students, Sean Corrigan. This was really his space, so he'll probably be able to clarify it better than I, but he uses a really nice analogy of, like, you're at the beach and you've got sets of waves coming in. And so when people talk about heart rate, they assume it's always like a metronome steady beat all the time, but that's not actually what's happening. So what's happening is we're getting, if you think like an ECG trace, the heart rate trace, what we're actually seeing is variation between those peak beats. So like the peaks of the wave coming through, it's not always the same time interval between those peaks. So when we're talking about variability in the heart rate, it's the variability between those peaks and the waves coming through.
And I'm interested in your thoughts. I sort of almost know the answer to this, but is there good and bad? You know, it's an interesting metric in that high is better as a general rule, but, you know, are there... Well, how do we interpret this data, I guess, is the question I'm asking.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's going to be individual variability. I think one of the challenges with a lot of the biomarkers is there's often huge individual variability. So you need to know your own baseline. And typically, yes, high variability is good, except for you can have extremely high variability, like in survival situations where you're trying to conserve calories and that sort of thing. So then you might have a very artificially, well, it's not artificially high, but high is not always better. But for the most part, yes, higher is better.
If you were searching for a wearable, you were encouraging their use, what would be one that you would go to that you think is consistent to deliver you, you know, 70% accuracy across biomarkers? We have this raging debate all the time. I just like the Apple Watch. Ben's got Whoop. Dan's got an Oura Ring. He's used Fitbit. Yeah. We've got a Muse headset in the office here. We've tried everything.
There are lots of toys out there, and they're always fun to play with. And I will preface this by saying I don't get any funding. I'm very happy for them to sponsor me. My go-to has always been the Oura Ring over the years, just because it's easy to put on. You're not getting constant data that you're thinking about, but obviously, and it has been validated. The sleep metrics have been validated against the gold standard polysomnography. So for me, that's a good tick in that sense. And, you know, the temperature changes things to be really sensitive and, you know, early detection of when you're going to get sick. Yeah. So I've been really happy with the Oura Ring. Depends what you're trying to get out of the wearable, like what data you want to get and why and how you're going to use that. Recently, I purchased a Garmin, the solar one, 7S, and I have absolutely been loving that, in part because over the last 3 years with kids, I hadn't really been training much. And so for me, it was much a toy to get back into training. And I found that's been really good in terms of letting me know my current training state and when I need to take a bit of recovery time or when I can push a bit harder. So from a training point of view, I've been, super impressed with the Garmin.
Speaking of training, Ben will get sick of me talking about Dr. Ali Crum at Stanford, but she's one of my favourites. That she's a researcher largely on mindset, amongst other things, but she's put herself in the petri dish. She was a pro athlete who, we always think that mindset's a kind of a good thing, you need to have it, but she's an example where you can have a mindset that's nearly too powerful. She finishes a training session with her team, they all go away to rest, recuperate, she goes back into the gym, and guess what happens next? She gets injured. And so she talks about it in context with her experiences. You were interested in sport, you wrote a PhD on athletes, but you've also coached. You've coached swimming, running, cycling, you've actually also competed. We saw the Vancouver age group competition some years ago.
You have done your research.
How important has that been? Not, you know, just wearing your Oura Ring or your wearables or saying you should do it, but putting yourself inside the petri dish to do these little stress tests.
Yeah, absolutely. And during my PhD and certainly my honours, I used to call myself my own best case subject in terms of the overtraining. And yeah, I just started the sport of triathlon around the time I started my honours. And I remember going to my supervisor, who was also a triathlon coach, said, my shins are really sore. It was a race. It was a duathlon. I was like, should I run today? And he's like, he started rubbing his thumbs up my shins. And, and he's like, no, you know, I clearly had stress fractures. And it was, you know, I'd gone too far. So that was a very early insight into what happens when you don't manage your training well. From that, yeah, I think for me it's, and certainly coming back to that training point, like coming back to being active again, it's just so important to who I am and my sense of self. And I think, you know, as you talk about your mental health, maintaining mental health during periods of stress, physical activity is essential for me to maintain that mental health piece.
Mm. Well, staying with that, so performance, however the listener defines it, whether it's financial performance or performance at home as a stay-at-home dad or as an athlete or a military person or a firefighter, in your experience with yourself as an athlete, coaching athletes and also researching, what would be the takeaways, the non-negotiables that you know can improve performance?
Listen to your body. Listen to your body and don't ignore it. Don't underestimate the importance of rest and recovery. We don't adapt if you're not resting and recovering. That's when you have those positive adaptations from your body, so make sure you prioritize that. We like to think we're invincible and we can just keep going and going and going and going and going. And most of us can, particularly when we're younger, up until a point, and then if we get a little bit older, our bodies maybe aren't quite so forgiving. And I think that's when that recovery piece, the rehabilitation piece, becomes really important, and prioritizing it and making time for that.
Can I unpack one of those statements you made that we hear often, that listen to your body? This is my second dumb question for the podcast.
No such thing as dumb questions, just dumb
By no means it's my second dumb question for the series. What does that actually mean? So context for myself, I've gotten back into distance running. I've been really enjoying it. I'm experiencing all that sort of stuff. My mind still thinks I'm a 25-year-old and my body's got different ideas. But it's been very interesting at times to try to differentiate between what is actual early warning signs, and it's only afterwards that I think, oh, I wish I'd listened to my body back then, and what is just a soreness or a potential niggle as a result of increasing a training load to work up to an event. You know, how do you, what are those, what's that bit, listen to your body, that's the danger as opposed to your body just whinging because you're getting fitter?
Yeah, and there's probably a couple of things in that, and I'll try and remember all of those. I think one of them is it just a one-off? Like, is it just a once-off, and you've just done something, and, you know, and the next time you go out it's fine, then it's probably fine. I think if it's something that starts off as a niggle and is getting progressively worse, then maybe you need to have a little bit of a think about what's causing this. Have you rested enough? Do you need to stretch? Do you need to, you know, take care of yourself, do some sort of massage? Magnesium tablets have been in the water, have been my life-changing last few months, just from that muscle recovery point of view. It's that tracking, it's that serial monitoring to know whether it's a once-off or whether it's something else. And that recovery piece, coming into that recovery piece. Like for me, I've been struggling with Achilles tendonitis, so never had it before. But yep, I'm going to get fit last year, you know, went straight back into the training, and within a month, they were both flared and took me 6 months to get over it.
Yeah.
Now, this year, sort of coming back into it again. Right, Achilles, not entirely happy, but I'm managing I'm managing it, right? Like it hasn't flared up again, but I know I haven't fully got on top of it, so... just trying to, because sometimes when you go out, you're like, oh, I can't be bothered to train. You know, I'm tired. I've got all this other stuff on. But sometimes that's just a mental thing. That's not necessarily physically. Yeah. And also when you get out, it's like the best thing for you.
That's it. Yeah. And that's really at the crux of that question. You know, when is it a cop out versus when is it a smart decision? And to add a footnote to link to our previous conversation, I have found, and I'm by no means fully proficient in it, but interpreting that biometric data as well. And the thing I found really interesting about the wearables is that it's not just a one-off where you wake up in the morning and it says no, good or bad. You know, it's that trend and that monitoring. Okay, well, you know, my lifestyle has been pretty good the last few days, but my recovery's low. You know, that's starting to be a trend, not just that one sort of good or bad result. I found that useful.
100%. Yeah, 100%. It's the trends you look at. Mm. It's not the one-off. It's the trends that are important. And probably the last point is being aware of different types of pain. Like there's good pain and bad pain.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the good pain, that's when, like, you're pushing yourself hard in training and it's a little bit uncomfortable, but the bad pains, I think, when you got to stop.
Yeah.
Check with everybody.
Well, why don't you just wait here at the bar while I go outside and go around the corner and get our car? We'll leave this old town behind, buy some beer, drive down south till dawn. Or we can cruise down along the coast, maybe park down by the swell. Tune in to the big US radio, 18 million.
More recently, Luana, you've got interested in the military demographic. So athletes, understandable, you know, we love to take the lessons from athletes. But what is it about the military that piqued your interest, the research specifically on stress, broader resilience subjects in that military demographic?
I think for my mind, it's just the opportunity to have a greater impact. Like when we think... broadly, we are a small nation with a relatively smaller defence force compared to some other countries, with a smaller pipeline coming through. We need to do everything we can to try and enhance that pipeline and make sure we're not losing anyone unnecessarily due to potentially preventable injuries. Mm. And so there was an opportunity, the Defence created this Human Performance Research Network, and we were fortunate enough to get funding in the first initial round, and that's led on to ongoing collaborations with the Australian Army, and I've found them to be incredibly rewarding. And it's really like we've just all these things we've just talked about in terms of monitoring training, been translating that into the training environments and looking at what's happening and just making sure that recovery piece is in there and recognising we need to simulate, you know, various scenarios and demanding training so we know how we respond in those situations, but then making sure that there are those opportunities to recover as well. Yeah. So that those trends are being maintained.
Considering the two demographics, the athletes and military people, what does each do that the other should take a lesson from?
It's really tricky because they are very different environments. Like in the elite sport environment, it's kind of like the F1. You know, you've got your rehab, you know, you've got everything. You've got everything mm-hmm. you possibly need. And in the defence context, you've got to try and get everyone through at scale. And you've mm-hmm. so inevitably, you have to use a one-size-fits-majority approach. You can't be tailoring individual training yet. Hopefully in the future that may be more possible. I think in the future, wearables will likely become a part of that. Mm-hmm. We're not quite there yet. So at the minute, it's about what can we use that's low impost, low burden, that's going to give us maximum return on investment to monitor recruits as they're going through training to, yeah, get the best outcome for them.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, we differ from decathletes in the special operations community because it's not good enough for us just to maintain function without sleep, without nutrition. We actually have to be at our best in those environments where we're degraded and maybe the adversary isn't. I find that a really fascinating subject. And you've done a body of work with a good friend of ours, Dan Cooper.
Yes, Dan's work was really interesting. He did a really good job with that.
Yep, the only guy I've seen, well, I reckon body to weight ratio, maybe second to none in deadlift, about 260 kilograms.
Yeah, strong
did Coops. But yeah, interesting human. And that body of work was on cues, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, key utilization and looking at in our training environments, is what we're training people transferable to real world scenarios, or are they actually just learning the cues that are in the training environment? I think that's a really important distinction in those sort of shooting activities. It's, are we providing them the right training that they need that's going to then translate to those real world contexts?
And again, my recall might fail me here, but you realise that actually the training cues didn't translate to operational environments, that we were teaching potentially bad habit patterns and thinking processes in training?
Again, yeah, it's going to test me. It's been a little while since I read the thesis, but I wouldn't call them bad habits, but they were just learning training cues relevant to that particular environmental context.
Mm.
So then the question is, how do we then simulate training environments that more closely mimic real-world scenarios?
Yeah.
A more recent body of work you've done, which I found really interesting, was the impact of overtraining on cognitive function. And this idea, and correct me if I've misinterpreted this, but potentially we were speaking about some of the tests you could use to identify overtraining, and one of them could be a sort of cognitive function test. And if we see a drop in that, that could be a sign. Could you expand on that body of work?
Yeah, so I suppose my approach has always been not trying to be wedded to a particular measure or marker, and rather I don't think there's a single marker that's going to tell us what's going on, but trying to identify and triangulate the best combination of markers. So started off earlier in the career with subjective markers, still very much use those, looked at the circulating biomarkers like the inflammatory cytokines, but they're really expensive and not necessarily accessible to the wider audience just yet. The wearables are obviously there, and it's a constantly moving feast of what's available. And then I thought, well, hang on a minute, what else is there? And particularly noting in defense settings, there's an increased reliance on really demanding tasks. It's less about the breaking down doors and entering, although that still happens. But then the main mission is increasingly going to be the computer scientist that's then hacking into the mainframe or whatever it is they're doing. So the question then is, well, how is cognitive function going to be impacted by stress? And is potentially there something in cognitive function space that we could use to detect, you know, fatigue or, you know, the compromised performance? And so that was really just a systematic review. We wrote one in the overtraining space, and we've also done a paper about the potential relevance of, or the potential utility of, cognitive markers to detect fatigue in tactical pops as well.
That's very cool. And I noted that one of the potential tests you, or cognitive tests you used, was the Stroop test, which for our listeners, if you haven't done this, Google it, STROOP. It's one of those things where you've got a bunch of colours written in text of different colours, and you've got to say the colour of the text and not the word that you're reading. Which is actually really hard to do, rested and sober and straight and all that sort of stuff. I can only imagine trying to pull one of those out after the, you know, in the middle of a mission, or as you say, after 12 hours behind a keyboard.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and to clarify, that was a review, a systematic review. So not a lot of research has been done in this space. So I do feel like it's a great opportunity. And I think we only ended up having 7 papers in that review. So it was really a small sample. So certainly an area of interest moving forward.
Well, and certainly, I mean, we talk a lot in our resilience work about the relationship between performance and stress, as I mentioned before, and the impacts of stress, even from just a purely physiological level on your cognitive function. You know, the sort of amygdala response and the activation of your sympathetic nervous system, you know, does impact your higher order cognitive processes. And I think if we extrapolate that, certainly, I mean, we've made no secret of the fact, obviously, the SAS has been in the news for a lot of bad things, and a lot of them do relate, I think, to poor decision-making under pressure, either sort of chronic or acute. And, you know, this kind of relationship, I think, is fascinating because it's probably something militaries haven't focused on particularly well. You know, they are good at the martial skills, good at the physical fitness, good at the technical skills. I think this is a real area for opportunity for military law enforcement and other high performers.
No, absolutely. And that's one of the things we teach in sports psychology is the eyes off the individual zone of optimal functioning. And if you think like a funnel, like a sideways funnel, you've got, when you're under aroused, you've got all these cues in the environment that are both helpful and unhelpful. And when you're under aroused, you're basically just getting washed with everything. When you're over aroused, your focus becomes so narrow that you're missing out all the important cues as well as the unimportant ones. So it's about trying to identify what's that sweet spot where I'm getting all of the relevant cues. I'm focused enough on the task, but I'm not getting distracted by stuff that's not relevant.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly leans into that point.
Which sort of talks to a broader body of work. I sort of use that good, the bad and the ugly phrase about stress, which was the title of body of work you did a number of years ago now. What is the good, the bad and the ugly about stress?
Yeah, and I think that's the thing. People often have this connotation that stress is inherently bad. Stress isn't good or bad. It just is. It's the state of arousal, physiological or psychophysiological arousal that the body's under when presented with a situation. And I think it's making people aware that stress is just that activation of the body, your stress response, preparing you to fight, flight, flee at a fundamental level, And increasingly now, like in our environments, we are constantly being activated with, you know, little deadlines and niggles. Like this, we're just constantly at this sort of elevated level. And so instead of having, so when I talk about, you know, stop me if you want me to stop talking.
No, this is good.
There's two pathways is when you're activating a stress response. So you've got your sympathoadrenal medullary system or SAM, and then you've got your HPA axis. And one of them's giving you like that instant jab of adrenaline, like a syringe just to get you up and running. And then the cortisol response is just starts dripping like a leaky tap, and that's what sustains you at that elevated level. And so it's got a really important function from an evolutionary perspective to try and survive. But the problem is in our environment where we're constantly under these low-grade levels of stress that we're actually flooding the body with cortisol for sustained periods of time. And we know now that stress is linked with all sorts of negative health outcomes. And I forgot where I was going with that. But that's it. That's how I normally explain it. Oh, like the good, bad, and the ugly. That's right. So the good stress is when you... You know, you've got those butterflies and, you know, that means you actually care about what you're doing. You know, you care enough about it and so your body's ready to go. The bad is obviously when it impacts your performance and impacting your health. And the ugly is obviously when it impacts your long-term health because you've been at that sustained level of stress or stress exposure for far too long and your body starts to break down.
Yeah. Mm.
Any good examples of people who have all of this stimuli thrown at them in their athletic pursuits? You mentioned Lewis Hamilton F1 that are able to deal with it better. And you could probably make a throwaway line saying, well, anyone who wins an F1 or a gold medal. But are there good public examples of sports where you're bombarded with things and maybe your cognitive processes are more challenged, so therefore... those with the best cognitive performance combined with athletic performance do well.
Now, I'm a terrible sports scientist because I don't
have to watch the sports.
So I can't think of anyone off the top of my head, but I do think it's one of those really... So people that have been, you know, successful over a long period of time, and the only person that comes to mind is Sir Chris Hoy in the cycling space because he has managed to sustain or maintain or keep coming back to that performance level and over again. I mean, obviously he's retired now, but I think athletes that are able to have a career, a lasting career, you know, and be successful are obviously doing something right.
There's some interesting examples in that you know, CrossFit, the sport of fitness as it trademarks itself, where you need a lot of cognitive flexibility, where you've got to be a generalist, where general physical preparedness is really important because they just throw the activity at you sometimes with no notice, you know, 10 seconds and you're underway, which probably, requires physical adaptability but also cognitive flexibility. Have you watched any of that, and is that the sort of thing that interests you?
To be honest, I haven't. I like CrossFit as a concept. My concern is, I think it's excellent for people that are well-trained and have a really good base. My concern is when Joe Blogs off the streets tries to get straight into it and perhaps doesn't have the necessary foundation training or conditioning, which I'm sure there are places that provide that, but historically that hasn't been the case.
My personal view, I think, you know, kind of militaries were, and possibly the special operations communities were early adopters of it, and I love it as a training methodology. I dislike it as a sport, you know, the idea that, you know, you're prioritising time for some of these highly technical and potentially physically dangerous movements. Yeah. That's where I think even the best intention gyms, and there were some fantastic coaches and that, but, you know, yeah, okay, let's cut corners on form to get a few seconds. Yeah. I think that was potentially where...
Yeah, the emphasis was on the stress, wasn't it? Whether it was load or time or, you know, that whole competitive aspect, sacrificing things to win.
Correct. I think there seems to be a growing movement, more functional fitness. I think that has my curiosity piqued a bit more, just because it's a little bit more holistic than in the capabilities.
Yeah.
I haven't investigated that a lot yet.
What would you like to investigate? What are the bodies of work that you have not yet completed that might be in a black book somewhere that, you know, when you get funded by Aura or Whoop or Apple or Instagram or God knows whom, that you will undertake?
Keep doing more of what I'm doing. Yeah, absolutely. there's always research questions. Like, I think the inflammatory marker space, we need a wearable that can measure it. I would love to create a biopatch that's measuring interstitial inflammatory markers in real time for extended periods of time. I mean, that's been a sort of a next horizon project that I've been, I'm just waiting for the technology to catch up. Mm. And there is theoretically the capacity to do it now. It's just, as you say, having the funding to develop that. So
would it be along similar lines to those continuous blood glucose monitors? So sort of invasive probe and...
Yeah, but hopefully less invasive than the blood glucose one. So the with the microneedle technology now, it's not even going much deeper than the dermis. So it's just a patch, and they use it for drug detection. But and I think there are some groups that start, like, the technology is being developed. It's just trying to get the funding and do it.
Could that same technology support blood lactate testing?
Oh, probably. Yeah, probably.
Because that's been an interesting breakthrough for people following sort of distance running, the Norwegian method, these double interval sessions where they're training very much dictated by blood lactate, so not overtrain, so get just exactly the right stimulus based on finger prick tests, literally on the track after each rep. I mean, something like that, a continuous test would be wonderful in that. Yeah,
I think everything's possible in some senses when it comes to the biomarker space. Mm. We're talking about assays that can be done on the phone. It's just a question of the technology and the cost sort of catching up.
Yeah. You combine that sort of objective biometric data with maybe a subjective diary and how I feel, backed by AI trend analysis and data crunching, that's starting to get a really powerful, not only training, but sort of lifestyle and healthy well-being tool, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's almost the holy grail. Yeah. The holy grail is having sufficient data that you can start data mining it, that you've got the combination, as you say, of the wearables and the field report and the biomarkers. That is the goal. It's just a question of when we'll get there.
Mm. Future research, getting fit, staying fit, all your work in supervising those who are doing their PhDs and being a mum. What do you do for you?
Yes.
What do you do for you?
I train.
Yeah.
That's what I do for me. I think, yeah. So, I mean, tonight, for example, when the kids are having, or after the kids have had dinner, I'll head out on the bike for an hour.
Do you have an event in mind? What's the next goal training-wise?
I did. I was hoping to do Geelong 70.3 on the weekend, but I was on track until sort of January, and then the Achilles sort of spanner and all that. So the bike and the swimming was no worries, but the run had to back off. So I'll look for something else. That's sort of like the reset moment. I'll look for another one maybe later in the year and try again.
Mm, nice.
Would you do something just pure cycling?
Well, yeah, so I did the Cadell Evans People's event in January, which was 113Ks. So I sort of, so that was all right. That was good. A bit hilly, but no, that
to,
was really
to
good.
Compete or to participate, Luana?
I was participating. I'm at the point now, I don't feel that I have to compete. It's more just being, I just want to be at that fitness level that I can just go and run 21Ks because I want to. I can just jump on the bike and ride 100Ks. I love open water swimming. I can just go down to the bay and do 2Ks in the water. It's, I don't have to be fast, and I think that helps with that looking after yourself. I just want to be able to, to do it.
And what keeps you going on these training sort of rides, runs and swims? We often ask our guests, what are their power songs? Have you got a sort of go-to song that always gives you that extra gear?
I don't actually listen to music when I'm training.
Really?
Just from a safety perspective. Mm. I mean, funny story, when I was doing my last half of one of my half Ironmans previously, Finding Nemo?
Yeah.
And she's like, just keep swimming, just keep swimming. That got stuck in my head on repeat for whatever leg it was. So sometimes that'll come to mind, but often that's just a very mindful experience. When I'm out, I just like the quiet and just the peace and quiet. Like, I've got three kids. And so for me, it's just that space and time and place just to be present in the moment. So it's really sort of without being a mindful activity deliberately, it is a very just mindful moment of just being out and enjoying it.
Do you, I mean, Tim asked about visualization before. Do you use mantras at all when you are either training or racing?
So when I'm doing a race, I'll always do a visualization of the transitions. So sort of like the night prior or leading up to it, what are my transitions? And then I'll run through that mentally, that mental rehearsal piece. Find a lot of box breathing, I suppose. Pyramid breathing if I can't get to sleep. Probably less now than maybe in the past. Like we used to deliver psychological skills training for sporting groups many years ago, and so I think they're all fantastic, but don't deliberately or regularly probably adopt any of them myself. It's just nice to get out and just enjoy it. I think not putting my pressure into myself to be finishing in a particular place. It's just the act of I'm just grateful that I can get out there and do it again because I wasn't always able to.
It is pretty cool, and I wish you all the best recoveries with the Achilles. I'm currently, and I'm jinxing myself as I say that, but I'm currently running injury free, and I'm really trying to just notice and just enjoy that, you know, I'm doing this without niggles, and the warm up's so much quicker, and I'm trying to be aware of that. Whereas in the past, I think that was just the default, and you only noticed when you're injured. But now that I'm old, just that awareness that hey, my body is moving, and this is a blessing, really.
Yeah, 100%. I did 10Ks. Sunday, I think it was, just went out for a run, and I was just grateful to be out there. And I mean, of course, it's not easy to do, but it's not impossible, and it's just great to be out there. I think I'm much more grateful of that now than I ever was in the past.
Yeah,
having had a full rupture of an Achilles, I would not recommend it. There's definitely better ways to spend 12 weeks or 18 months actually until you're back to full flexibility and fitness and running cleanly. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a good reminder to keep up the stretching and the rehab so that doesn't
happen. Yes. Yeah. That sheath can be massaged, and you can do a little bit of self-help ahead of getting those sort of tendon pain.
Well, Luana, we'll try and find some soundtrack of Dory saying, just keep swimming, just keep swimming, and add that to our Unforgiving 60 playlist. But short of that, thank you. Your reflections have been really brilliant, I think not only for the podcast writ large, but certainly for me personally in a whole bunch of different areas. So really appreciate your time.
Excellent. No worries. Thanks for having me on the show.
Cheers.
Thanks a lot.
Now to the debrief. We relentlessly pursue excellence and would love your insights and feedback. Also, if you know someone who is living a life less ordinary, let us know. You can get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's debrief@unforgiving60.com. If you have enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and rate us on iTunes. You can also follow us on social media. Just search for Unforgiving 60 on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Until next time, we wish you luck in filling your unforgiving 60s with some quality distance run. I went over to the external Zesky to get myself one of my favourite ales. I wrapped a hand around a can, then a hand wrapped around my head, and I looked up to see the face of one Dick Dale. Turned around and he asked the same thing of me. I said, yeah, you're Dick Dale, so get your hand off my ale. I've killed a man for less than one BV. Do you wanna see? Yeah!